thoughts made her uneasy, especially when she realised that others, like Dame Agatha, had noticed. If her father had been here, she might have confided in him. Sabrina usually kept her own counsel, even with her cousins. People turned to her with their problems, not the other way around. Her pride... Her mind stopped on the word. She would never confide in anyone. She wouldn't let anyone see her weaknesses. If she was lonely, she hid it. If she was angry, she swallowed it. If she was tired, she pressed on. If ill at ease, she faked confidence.
She would not wear her feelings for all to see, because then she would be admitting she could be hurt. She'd feel exposed. Sabrina prepared a bowl of broth for Mr. Enright. She tore a piece of bread to soak in it, reasoning he might be able to digest a bit more than liquid today, and it would be good for him. She went upstairs. He lay on his back exactly where she had left him. He didn't appear to have moved, not even an inch. She stood in the doorway a moment and listened. To her relief, she heard the sound of a deep, even slumber. He was beginning to recover. She felt his brow and was relieved. It was cool to her touch. His fever had broken and would not return. The danger of chills had passed. All he needed now was time to regain his strength. Setting the bowl on the bedside table, Sabrina raised a hand as if to thank God, but instead was suddenly overcome with a wealth of emotion that had nothing to do with her patient. He was going to survive. Something had finally gone right in her life. But now what? Now what? Huge, racking sobs that she could not control escaped her. She broke down completely. There were tears for herself, for what she'd sacrificed, for what she'd lost. Some of the tears were ones she'd held back when her mother had died. These tears had been inside her all this time. A Davidson did not show strong emotion, not over something like death. One carried on. However, the need to grieve had been there, always there. And while she was crying, she might as well let loose a bout of temper over how easily her father had gone on. He'd taken a mistress. The valley was not London. Tongues wagged, and eyes saw everything. By now, a good number of people probably suspected that he was staying with Mrs. Bosley. They knew Sabrina was unimportant. That last word made her wince. It also brought her to her senses and forced her to end her indulgence in tears. Crying never solved anything. Her mother used to say those words. Sabrina crossed to the wash basin and splashed cold water on her face. She caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror. Her fit of tears had not enhanced her looks. Her cousin Tara always looked so fetching when she cried. Sabrina was not like her. She blew her nose and faced her reflection. From now on, I shall think of myself first. Her statement didn't sound convincing even to her own ears. I shall think of myself first, she declared, her voice more determined. Now she sounded like a fool. Sabrina faced her patient. He'd slept through her fit. Her cousin Eileen had always claimed that a good cry eased the soul. Sabrina didn't feel eased. She felt as if she could curl up on the bed beside Mr. Enright and sleep for a week. Drawing a fortifying breath and releasing it, Sabrina attempted to feed him a bit of the broth, cooing encouraging words as she did so. When she had poured as much of it as she could down his throat, she rolled up his shirt and removed the herb poultice she had wrapped around his chest. Dipping a cloth into water from the wash basin, she began washing the remnants of the ointment off of his skin. He made a face as his skin dried in the air, but did not wake. The man was exhausted. She'd seen patients sleep 24 hours and more after overcoming the fever he had experienced. His body was repairing itself. Sleep could do more for a soul than all the leeches and medicines of the healer's art. What was interesting was that, last night, she had been so worried about him. She had barely noticed the lean muscles of his ribcage and the hard planes across his chest. He had a scar along his side. She wondered about the story behind it. He was also younger than she'd first imagined. A shave would transform him. And, curious, she fetched her father's shaving kit. Sabrina sat on the bed close to the headboard and lifted his head to rest on her leg. She lathered his chin and jaw. She'd shaved patients a time or two before. She now ran the razor across his skin. He had a strong, noble nose and well-formed lips. It was a pleasure to watch the character in his face revealed. He was not classically handsome, but had a look that would turn heads whenever he passed. And soon, he would go on with his life. She looked down at the peacefully sleeping Mr. Enright. Yes, she did find him attractive. He was far more handsome than Mr. Burnett, and was definitely the sort of man a woman would like to kiss. An idea struck Sabrina. A desire. She could hear Rolf barking outside, probably at a rabbit. But here, in this room, there were no sounds other than their breathing. She was alone with this man. He didn't even know her name, and yet she felt close to him. He'd been delivered to her care, and he would survive. In a matter of days, their lives would go in different directions. So what would be the harm in stealing a kiss? To discover what it felt like. To pretend for just a moment that she had a sweetheart. If she was with him, there wasn't a woman in the valley who wouldn't feel a touch of jealousy. Sabrina looked down at the man resting on her leg. He had very kissable lips. She'd never noticed that about a man before. But then, there was a presence about Mr. Enright and his lips. They were thin, masculine, tempting. She told herself a kiss was an impulse, a bit of curiosity, that and no more. But she could also feel the reckless pull of desire. Before she let doubts arise, Sabrina bent over and placed her lips over those of the sleeping man. Chapter 7. The doors were driving Mac to madness. He jogged through the cavernous tunnels, opening one glowing white door after another. His gram was no longer here. She'd left him. While he'd been talking to her, she had disappeared, her image growing fainter as she listened to his story. She was gone. They were all gone, just as in life. His brother, his mother, Moira. And now, when he opened the cavern's glowing doors, he returned to his cell at the old toll booth, the condemned man's cell with its foul smell and the rickety cot. He'd slam one door shut and run to the next, then the next. Sometimes he heard the voices of his brother and Moira. She had been known for her laughter, almost as much as her fresh-cheeked beauty. Beautiful Moira, the woman he had loved and lost. Occasionally, as he tore through the tunnels, Mac thought he could hear the sound of children. He knew without being told they were Lorcan and Moira's. He'd never met them. Gone. All gone. Overwhelming sadness settled upon him, and his only salvation was her voice. His angel. Mac was immersed in the moment, but he also knew he dreamed. A part of him still had reason. He'd had patients, so exhausted by illness they slept as if dead. When they were well, they'd tell him of their dreams. Some even believed they had gone to another side, the place where death resided, and returned. Mac didn't put any faith in their words. After almost 10 years of fighting Napoleon's war, he'd seen enough of death to know there was nothing supernatural to it. What waited for both sinner and saint was emptiness, the same sadness that filled his life, and had done so for a long time. Now, as he wandered the halls, he wondered when he'd lost passion for life. That loss had been his reason for returning home, of wanting to reach out and forgive what had happened between himself, Lorcan, and Moira. Perhaps then he'd feel a sense of purpose. But they were all gone. And he would have happily given himself over to death as well, if not for his angel. He heard her cry, and silently rejoiced when she'd found her spirit and began to speak to him again. The melodic lilt of her words was sweeter than music. And she was close. Somewhere behind one of these doors, he just couldn't find her. Lips brushed his. The caverns with their maze of doors disappeared. Mac was in Edinburgh in the room he'd rented. And it was night. The night Godanarani had joined him in his bed. He'd not invited her. The girl had taken it upon herself to be there. He'd been drunk almost to the point of a stupor, as he'd been most nights. He'd been lost in grief and regret. His brother's ghost haunted him. Good Anna was such a lovely lass, but she was young, and Mac didn't want the burden of using her. She had kissed him, but he hadn't wanted her. He was done with using people. He was done with anger. The time had come to leave self-pity behind. He'd made the decision that night, a drunken promise to change. The girl had not taken his rejection happily. She'd left and, hours later, had been murdered. And now she kissed him, the taste of her sweet. When he pulled away, he found he craved her kiss. Too soon, he wanted to say, and couldn't. He could not speak at all. He struggled to find his way out of the darkness to call her back. Then she kissed him again. As Mac remembered, Gordana had been very aggressive. She might have been young, but she knew her business, and she'd wanted what he had. In contrast, now, there was a shyness to her, as if she had liked the feeling of her lips against his and wanted to explore more. Her kiss stirred him with its gentle question, and he felt himself come roaring to life. Heat surged in his loins. He lived. They had not killed him yet. She started to pull away again. Mac reached for her, hooking his hand around her neck and pulling her down to him. There was a moment of resistance. Then her lips were against his, and this time, instead of being a passive partner, Mac kissed her back. Nor was this just any kiss. He searched for something, something hard to define, and yet it was here in her kiss. This was not Gordana. He knew that now. He kissed the angel, the woman whose kindness had kept him alive. There was magic in this kiss, hope, and he was not about to let her go. Mr. Enright's lips were harder than hers, and yet soft at the same time. Sabrina had meant to offer no more than a peck, the sort of kiss one gave the cheek of a relative or friend. She'd experienced no other sort. The moment she'd kissed him, she'd felt silly. Hers had not been the sort of kiss that poets praised. They talked of hearts and earthiness and delight. Sabrina's kiss with Mr. Enright had been more of a rubbing of lips, and not a very long rubbing at that. She tried it once, then tried it again, more out of curiosity the second time, and a hope not to be disappointed, because kissing, apparently, was an anemic thing. She'd prefer the camaraderie of a hug. Her thoughts broke off in a panic as his hand captured the back of her neck. Her heart leaped in shock that he'd moved with his own volition. Conscious thought vanished from her mind, to be replaced by embarrassment at being caught smacking her lips against his. How could she explain what she had been doing? The weight of his hand brought her lips back to his, and this time there was no simple brush of closed flesh. This time their mouths melded together. Sabrina had gasped in surprise, and Mr. Enright had taken advantage of her half-open lips, bringing potency to the kiss, making it daring. She was receiving her first true kiss, and perhaps her last. A smart woman would take full advantage. She'd missed so many opportunities in her life. She was not going to miss this one. Besides, she liked this kiss. His hand exerted gentle pressure, urging her to turn her head to just the right angle where they fit. Oh yes, they fit. For a long moment, Sabrina marvelled at how right this felt. It didn't seem silly at all. Well, perhaps if someone witnessed their lips locked on each other's, they might think they were amusing. But to Sabrina, this felt good, completely lovely and nice. Indeed, her whole body hummed with how lovely and nice it was. The kiss flowed through her, melting resistance, until she could think of nothing but the connection between them. She didn't even notice that Mr. Enright had repositioned himself until he drew her down onto the bed alongside him. And she let herself be drawn, even as the bedclothes made it difficult for her skirts to stay down. They gathered at her knees. She didn't care. She was too busy marvelling over the fact their lips had never once parted. Of course, Sabrina knew she should stop him. She wasn't too far gone to not realise this was an impropriety. She even made an attempt to sit up, but he placed a possessive hand on the curve of her hip, and she decided there was no harm in lingering a minute more, especially as the kiss began to change. He leaned into her, demonstrating there was more pleasure to be had the closer they were to each other. Her eyes closed, and Sabrina allowed herself the pleasure of the moment. She indulged her curiosity. As she kissed him, she could imagine she was breathing his soul, and she liked the idea. She was aware of the weight and presence of his body, and even the texture of his skin, in a way she hadn't been while tending him. Furthermore, he was warm in a comforting way, and she liked the scent of his skin, spicy and manly from the shaving soap, and a fragrance unique to him alone. His arm slid around her waist. He gathered her closer, and his tongue intimately touched hers. This was more than just a mere kiss. This was an invitation, an intimate one. And Sabrina was not repulsed. Instead, every fibre of her being came alive. He tasted good. He smelled good. He felt good. Her arm had found its way to his waist, her hand pressed against the small of his back. She experienced him not as a patient, but as man, sliding her fingers beneath his shirt. His skin was smooth except for the scar, and she traced the line of it up his side. A throbbing need began to build in her. Was this desire, this yearning to open all of herself to him, especially in the most intimate places? He slid his tongue along hers again, and Sabrina wrapped herself, arms, legs, hands, around him. And still the kiss deepened. It grew heated. He tasted her, devoured her. Dear God, she liked this kiss. Now she understood why the poets praised a kiss. There was more to it than she had ever imagined. And when Mr. Enright kissed her fully, without any reservations between them, she eagerly welcomed him, wanting more, more, and more. Her full breasts flattened against the hard muscles of his chest as he leaned over her. Yes, that chest, the one she had eyed with admiration. His hips fit with hers. But what robbed her of all reason, what sent her spirit on fire with delicious anticipation, was his hand upon her breast. Her naked breast. Sabrina had no understanding of how her dress had become unlaced, but she didn't care. She was undone and happy for it. If she'd had a will to set limits or think rationally, it had vanished. She now became a new being. Had she once exercised good sense? How ridiculous of her. She liked this. She was light and laughter and need. Oh yes, she needed him. Capturing Mr. Enright's jaw with both her hands, she kissed him with all the budding passion inside her, and he responded. He was as hungry as she was. She wallowed in these kisses, revelled in them, and their magic was only heightened when he circled her hardened nipple with his thumb. She quivered, just as the poets had claimed she would. Her loins were on fire. Yes, she had loins, another one of those poetic terms used to describe lust. She'd never read the word loins again without recalling this exquisite heat ignited by his touch. Deep within her, a pressure was building. The word desire beat through her veins. Yes, she desired him. Right now, she couldn't live without him. Please, she heard herself whisper against his lips. Please, please, please. He knew what she wanted. His leg slid between hers. His hand raised her skirts even higher, so they were gathered around her waist. She was exposed to him, but she didn't feel vulnerable or afraid. For the first time in her life, she felt completely alive. Being this close to him, having his body all around her, feeling his hips resting on hers, was better than kissing. She could feel his hardness. She wasn't naive. She knew the differences between men and women, but she had never experienced them, and right now Sabrina was caught up in the experience. His weight felt good. His touch was not gentle, but demanding, insistent. At last, their kiss broke. His breath was hot against her ear as he whispered, I need you. I need you. What perfect words. In all of Sabrina's life, only her mother had needed her, and solely because, as an invalid, she'd had no other choice. But this man wasn't bound to her, other than through their kisses. His lips brushed her temple. Even that simple contact gave her pleasure. The first sweep of his hand against her most intimate parts was shocking. The touch jerked her out of the haze she'd been lulled into.
"Steady,"
he said. His low voice touched a deep chord, connecting her body with the stimulation of his knowledgeable hand. He nuzzled her neck, kissed her ear, and she thought she could linger a moment longer. He was trying to make her happy, and succeeding.
"Sweet angel," he murmured.
Sabrina smiled. No one had ever described her as an angel or sweet. He made her feel like one. Certainly she no longer felt of this earth, and she'd do anything she must to be what he wanted. His lips captured hers once more. Such delicious lips. No wonder she liked kissing them. Her hands found their way under his shirt. The buttons of his breeches were undone. She didn't know how or when that had happened, but she liked it. She now had access to the hard muscles of his abdomen and the curve of his hip. It was long and lean, and his skin felt warm and smooth beneath her palm. The scent of him made her wild with wanting. Sabrina was no longer the woman everyone thought her. "Look at me now, Dame Agatha. I'm living fully." She was who she wanted to be, and if all the women in the parish had tromped into this bedroom behind her father, she could not have stopped herself from relishing the hard planes of his chest and from pressing liquid need against his hardness. The thrust, sure, steady and demanding in its strength, surprised her. She barely registered the fact that he was inside her, when sharp pain tore through the magic of the moment, dousing it with reality. His naked hips were cradled between her thighs. Her stockings had fallen, although she still wore her shoes. Her skirts were around her waist. His breeches were not around his waist. His hips, his buttocks were muscular and strong. All of him was strong, and she knew because she felt as if he was splitting her in two. And there was the problem. Sabrina had been so caught up in the wonder of discovery. She now discovered herself, no longer a virgin. The shock sent her mind reeling. Her first inclination was to run, to escape. She started to scramble out from underneath him, but he braced his arms so they formed a wall around her.
"No," he whispered, his voice ragged. "You can't leave now. Not now."
Sabrina shook her head. The pain was ebbing, but her body felt uncomfortably stretched and full of him.
"I must leave."
"No," he said, drawing out the word as if cooing to her. "Please, I can't let you go. The damage is done. Just give yourself a moment."
He was right. There was no going back. The will to struggle against him left her. It was her fault. She'd kissed him. She'd orchestrated her own destruction. He frowned as if he was truly seeing her for the first time, a question clear in the brown gold depths of his eyes, and he said the words that completed her humiliation.
"Who are you?"
She bucked her hips with all her might, attempting to throw him off while she shoved his chest away from her, but her actions brought him into her deeper. The penetration no longer hurt, nor did it feel awkward. Her body had grown accustomed to him.
"Don't," he whispered. "I'd not harm you. Not my angel,"
he added, then began speaking to her in Gaelic, gentling her, Irish Gaelic. From the cadence of his speech, he was reciting a poem to her, and the language of it was beautiful. Some words she recognised. There were words of praise for her beauty, for her generosity, for the lady he called his love. The tension eased inside her. His gaze focused on her, his expression sombre. He traced the line of her lower lip with the tip of his thumb. And then he kissed her. Oh, his deadly kisses. Her heart kicked up its beat. Her blood heated, and she opened herself to him. She could not prevent the response, not with him so intimately joined with her. But even then, she was drawn to him. And he was right. What was done could not be undone. He began moving, this time with new strength and focused intent. He'd given her a chance to accept him, and now that she had, he was taking full advantage. Mr. Enright took her hand that was still pressed against his chest and moved it to the pillow above her head.
He laced his fingers with hers and went deeper, and it felt good. Sabrina's hips rose to meet him. He kissed her brow, he kissed her nose, her eyes, the curve of her cheek. She didn't fight. She couldn't. This was the great rite of passage for a woman. She could not say that he had cruelly ripped her virtue from her, or strangely that she regretted giving this to him. At last she understood the mystery between men and women. She also knew she would never forget this moment. She would recall the texture of the sheets beneath her and the give of the mattress. She would remember that the air was cool but her skin hot. She would inhale the memory of the scent of them and would have the vision of his hard, lean body with that wicked scar. And, she decided, she would not be sorry she'd done this. The pain was gone. In its place was the knowledge of the most incredible intimacy. Above her, his eyes had lost their sharpness. They'd darkened with desire. She noted that his teeth were white and even, and in spite of his illness, he was a formidable man. She'd chosen well for a lover. A lover? Would that be true? He was taking the utmost care of her. She was no longer afraid, not of him, and when she relaxed, her pleasure escalated until she was drowning once again in this newly learned hunger. And hungry she was. She strove with him, without fully understanding where they were going. Instead, she trusted him. He knew what she needed. He kissed her, this kiss so deep it seemed to turn her inside out. Sabrina shook off his hand holding hers and threw her arms around his neck, needing to be closer to him. She hooked her leg on his hip. Their joining took on a new intensity. She suddenly couldn't wait for him. Something drove her, something intangible. The heat between them grew more forceful. His thrusts took on purpose. She was on fire. She could not think, she could only feel. And what she felt was beyond anything she could have ever imagined. She was reaching for what was just beyond her grasp. And then she discovered it. Her body tightened, opened, then seemed to implode with her release. Relentless, intense emotion poured through her. Nothing could have prepared her for this experience. It defied all description. It was a world unto itself. It was the universe. She'd never imagined that such vivid, encompassing feelings could exist. Mr. Enright buried himself in her, and she felt his release. This was what it meant to become one. Now she understood. She relished the experience. Her body felt perfectly right, well used, happy, content, completely and utterly satisfied. Until she realized she knew nothing of this man other than his last name. She'd broken every rule of conduct she'd established for herself. She'd liked it. She'd like to do it again, and again. Did that make her a Widow Bosley? And what would happen to her if she became with child? Then everyone else would know what she'd done. Everyone. She would be the fodder of gossip for decades to come. Sabrina lay on her bed, the one she'd slept on since childhood, her clothing in wanton disarray, her body growing cold, and her mind boiling over with 100 chaotic questions. And she wanted to scream. He, on the other, rolled over on his side, threw a possessive arm across her body, and with a contented sigh, fell into a deep, peaceful sleep. Chapter 8. Sabrina glared at the man snoozing beside her and had two impulses. One was to run, and the other to double her fists and pound him. She decided to run. His arm was as heavy as a tree branch across her chest. His weight, which she'd easily tolerated moments ago, was now unwieldy. Using both hands, she lifted his arm, then didn't know how to place it beside his body without it being at an awkward angle. He might wake, and she didn't want that. So, as stealthily as a thief, she eased out from under his arm, landing on her bottom on the floor. A sharp glance assured her he had not noticed anything amiss. He slept on, as if he hadn't turned her world inside out.
Sabrina jumped to her feet, pulling her bodice up over her shoulders and shaking out her skirts to restore her modesty, and found she hated the dress she wore. She'd never wear it again. She couldn't, without recalling this moment in vivid detail. That he'd so easily and completely bypassed her good sense and judgment to claim her virtue, then had the audacity to sleep, as if he didn't have a care in the world, made her irrationally wish to burn the dress. She tiptoed to her wardrobe, pulled out her forest green day gown, the one she liked to save for doing charity work, and rushed from the room. At the foot of the stairs, she stopped to take stock of her situation. She was so thankful that Mrs. Patton was not here to witness her humiliation. Then again, if the housekeeper had been here, if her father had not left her alone with this man, well then, things would not have gone as they had. She would not have dared to shave Mr. Enright, let alone kiss him. Even now her senses were full of him. His scent was on her skin and in the most intimate places. With an angry sound at her own culpability, because, after all, her vanity had started what had happened, she hurried to the kitchen and stoked the fire. She went outside, her movements determined. She was very conscious of muscles she'd never known existed, in places she couldn't have imagined. She pumped water into the bucket. Rolf came bounding up to her. She threw her arms around him. "I'm such a fool, Rolf." His wagging tail assured her he adored her no matter how far she'd fallen, but Sabrina could not let her failings rest. As she marched into the house and put the water over the fire to heat, she flayed herself with the number of times she'd been sharply critical over the behaviour of other young women, including her cousin Tara. She'd accused Tara of flaunting herself and, quite frankly, considering herself superior to her cousin. Well, now, Sabrina was guilty of the same offence. She'd thrown herself at Mr. Enright, and he didn't even know her name. She had to keep it that way. Somehow, she must manage to push him out of the house without his being the wiser to whom she was. She'd have Mrs. Patton tell him to leave or send for her father. No, wait, she couldn't do that. He'd want to know what the man was doing under his roof, and one thing would lead to the other, and Sabrina would confess all. She didn't even want to think of the worst, that she could bear this man's child. God could not be that cruel. All she'd wanted was one kiss. The family bathed in the kitchen where the fire was always burning. Sabrina pulled the tub from its storage place under the shelves of the pantry. She also kept towels and soaps in a small pail there as well. She shut the kitchen door, pushing the heavy table in front of it, since there was no lock. This was a precaution against Mr. Enright's accidentally meandering around the house. As quickly as she could, she prepared her bath. She threw her clothes to the floor, climbed into the tub, and scrubbed herself senseless. If she could wash away the last hour of her life, she would have. But she couldn't. It had happened. She'd seen proof on her clothing. And she became angry. No one must ever know of this. No one. She hugged her legs up close to her body in the tub, fantasizing over the possibility of Mr. Enright's vanishing or wandering off into the world, never to be seen or heard from again. But whether he did or not, she knew what she'd done. A secret like this was a burden, unless confessed. If her cousin Eileen had been in Scotland, she might have turned to her. No. The only person she had close at hand was her father, and suddenly she wanted him to come home. Moments ago, she'd not wanted him to know. Now she needed his presence. She didn't like being alone with Mr. Enright and that seductive voice of his. She didn't want to face him without someone she trusted by her side. Unfortunately, her father was with Mrs. Bosley, and she would not go to the widow's house to fetch him. However, her uncle might retrieve him for her. Leaving the house to search out her uncle might be a good thing. Distance always offered perspective. With a plan of action, Sabrina dressed quickly, moved the table back where it belonged, and went into the hall for her hat and gloves. She listened a moment. She heard no sound from the upstairs, so she had to check on her patient. She must. Curiosity encouraged her to do so. His large body overflowed her bed. He slept as if his conscience was clear. Could he not know what had happened between them and demonstrated a modicum of angst, or pretend to share her regrets? Disconcerted, Sabrina flew to the stables. She hitched Dumpling to the cart and set off for Anfield. Mac woke with a start.
By the angle of the light coming through the window, he sensed the day was well advanced. For a long moment, he lay still, trying to place his bearings. He didn't remember this room, and it had been years since he'd slept on such a comfortable mattress or had sheets this fresh. His memory returned in snippets. He'd escaped from the toll booth. He remembered that. He'd been ill. He could recall the fatigue, the dizziness, the nausea. There had been a point when he'd been close to death's door. He felt weak, but good right now. He'd had dreams, wild, nonsensical ones. He had a vague recollection of who was in those dreams. He knew he'd searched for Lorcan, he thought, and Moira. Gram had been present. Then he remembered the angel. Intense, vague images came to his mind, images with taste and texture. The scent of her was all around him. He could have reached for her, expecting her to be beside him, but he was alone. Mac lifted himself up to rest on one arm and took in the furnishings of the room. The wardrobe was ajar, and he could see frocks hanging there. The pitcher and basin on the washstand were plain but decidedly feminine in style and form, and there were bits of lace in the curtains. Oh yes, this was a woman's room.
"What have you done with yourself now, Mac?"
he asked the world at large, and, of course, received no answer. God had never been generous with him. His stomach rumbled. A bowl on the bedside table caught his attention. There was also a small pitcher for water and a stack of rags that could be used for a number of purposes. His memory sharpened on her. She had creamy skin, dark hair, and a kindness in her eye that had assured him he was safe. For once in his life, he'd allowed himself to trust someone, and she'd kept him alive. He remembered the shepherd's hut. If he'd been left there, he probably would have come down with a croup and never survived. How the bloody hell had he arrived here? And where was she now? Where was he now? He listened for sounds of activity in the house, but all was quiet. There wasn't even a ticking of a clock. Mac was also hungry, ravenous. He needed to eat and drink. He reached for the small pitcher and downed the contents. There was nothing left in the bowl, and he had to find something. His body demanded sustenance. As he sat up, ready to put his feet over the side of the bed, the blanket wrapped around him fell to the side. His breeches were undone, his shirt up to his chest. His angel had done more than keep him alive, and those vague images became more defined. Just the thought of her had him stirring. Oh, yes, he did remember. She'd been a generous lover, an intense one, open to whatever he asked of her, and he wondered where she was now. Theirs had been no ordinary coupling. Mac rose to his feet, righting his clothing as he did so, and combing his tangled hair back with his fingers. He rubbed his jaw with the back of his hand, and was surprised to discover he was clean-shaven. She'd done that. He buttoned his breeches. His boots were on the other side of the night table, but Mac didn't pause to put them on. He wanted to know where he was and who she was. He was also interested in knowing how far he was from Kenmore in his quest to find the Reverend Kinnean, his only link to Richard Davidson. The upstairs floor had three bedrooms. The room he'd been in had definite feminine touches, but the others were neat, clean, and lacking personality. There was a door at the end of the hall that led to the attic stairs. He checked the bedrooms and found a wardrobe containing a gentleman's clothes. The wardrobe in the third bedroom had a man's jacket and two shirts, items that appeared to have not been worn recently. Perhaps someone had used the room and left these behind. Whatever the case, he now knew there was the woman and at least one man living here. No servants. He didn't see signs of one. Mac tried one of the shirts. He'd been wearing what he'd had on for too long. He yearned for clean clothes. Unfortunately, it was too small. He went down the stairs. His stockinged feet didn't make a sound on the treads. The house seemed foreign to him. Nothing was familiar, a sign that he might have been more ill than even he realised when he'd been brought under this roof. There was a dining room with a table, chairs, a sideboard and brass candlesticks, not silver. A pianoforte took up one corner of the sitting room across the hall, and there were a few chairs, one upholstered
arranged around the musical instrument and the cold hearth. Mac walked down the hall and discovered the kitchen. Several loaves of bread were laid out on a table in the middle of the room. Mac fell on one of them, pulling off great hunks of the loaf and stuffing them in his mouth. The bread was delicious. Then, again, anything, including cabbage, his least favourite food, would have tasted of ambrosia. He poked around the pots set around the fire and the hearth. There was what appeared to be a mutton stew there. A bit more nosing around revealed the pantry. It was well stocked. There was bacon, ham, onions, and, to his delight, meat pies. He'd finished the loaf of bread, so he helped himself to a pie, which he washed down with a jug of sweet cider. Mac was beginning to feel himself again. There was a bathing tub with cool water beside the hearth. A linen towel was hanging to dry over one of the cooking hooks. A bar of soap was on the hearthstone. Mac picked it up and smelled it. The scent reminded him of roses and lavender, strong, evocative perfumes, and the fragrance of his angel. She'd shaved him, but he was in need of more grooming. Mac believed in regular bathing. He liked the way he felt when he bathed often, and he certainly preferred the way he smelled. As a physician, he'd observed that there was a correlation between health and cleanliness, all other beliefs to the contrary. He glanced at the door. Whoever lived here could return any moment, or they could be gone for hours. He wasn't one to waste an opportunity. Shutting the kitchen door, he pulled a chair from a row of them against the far wall. They probably belonged around the table, but it was easier to knead bread and make pies as delicious as the one he'd gobbled down if the chairs were not in the way. He propped the chair against the door. It wouldn't stop someone from coming in, but would give him time to shout a warning or defend himself, whichever the case might be. The temperature of the water was fine with him. He'd bathed in colder. He didn't even mind the scent of the soap. Mac unbuttoned his breeches, shucked off his pants, and froze. He'd assumed he'd had sex when he'd woken with his breeches undone and his little friend spent. What he hadn't realised until this moment was that the woman he'd so completely enjoyed had been a virgin. The signs were there. Mac frowned. He wasn't one to deflower the innocent. He rebuttoned himself, moved the chair, and went upstairs to re-examine the bed. On the sheets, he discovered more signs of her virginity. What the devil was he involved in? It was as if she had taken advantage of him, but to what purpose? And he wasn't certain he minded. He returned to the kitchen and tore off his clothes, not even bothering with the door. He climbed into the cold water, lathered the flower-scented soap, and washed himself thoroughly and completely from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. Sensible men did not pluck virgins. There was a price for such foolishness, especially when the man didn't know who the woman was. He didn't think she could be the wife of the house and still be intact, but if she was the daughter, well, things could become complicated. And if there was one thing a man wanted for murder didn't want, it was more complications. Just the thought of all that could go wrong made him dunk his head underwater. Still, he wasn't just anyone any longer. He was an earl, although he didn't feel worthy of being one. And of course, if there was a child, he would do the honourable thing. But first, he'd wait to meet the lady. Mac climbed out of the tub and dressed quickly. He combed his hair with his fingers before helping himself to another cup of cider, which he carried as he opened the door and went out into the hall. There was another room, a study with legal papers stacked on the desk. He set his cup down and started going through them, anxious for any clue as to the owner of the house. And then he saw the name on the signature line. Richard Davidson. For a second, he was stunned. His enemy, the man who could answer the question why, was either here or close at hand. And all Mac had to do was wait. The Earl of Tay let Sabrina cool her heels for 2 hours before he entered the morning room, where Ingold, the Tay butler, had asked her to wait along with some light refreshments. Her uncle did not look well. The Earl of Tay had once cut an imposing figure. Now he seemed a seedy one. His florid cheeks were at odds with the pasty skin of his neck and hands. His hair was greyer. He had a decided paunch and a stumble to his gait. He was still wearing his dressing gown over a shirt and breeches. His neckcloth had a large stain on it.
"You are drunk," Sabrina said in weary surprise, watching her uncle head to a side table boasting several bottles of port.
"The day is advanced,"
her uncle mumbled. He toasted her with a full glass before saying,
"Most of what I feel is from last night."
He downed the glass and poured another. "Wait," Sabrina ordered, moving to place a hand on his arm and prevent him from consuming another drink before she spoke. "I need your help." He stared at her through watery eyes.
Eh?
Her first inclination was to slap sense into him. Instead, she forced a smile.
I need for you to call on Mrs. Bosley and tell Father he must return home.
Eh?
Sabrina could feel her false smile stretch tighter. Her uncle tried to raise his arm to bring his glass to his lips. She held it down.
Father needs you.
Not if he is with Mrs. Bosley,
the Earl answered, sounding very lucid. He pivoted, escaping Sabrina's gasp, and took a sip of his drink.
He's probably very happy. He'll return home by and by.
But he is making a spectacle of himself,
Sabrina said, as if it should be obvious, and momentarily forgetting to whom she was speaking. He reminded her by saying,
Good for him. At our age, it is a mark of honour to be considered a spectacle. I hope Lily shows them a good time.
He paused, eyed Sabrina, and added,
You might consider making a bit of a spectacle yourself, lass. You are too serious for your own good.
If he'd known what a spectacle she'd made of herself already this day, he might not be so cavalier. And it was on the tip of her tongue to inform him. She'd had a good roll with a man whom, for all she knew, could be a common criminal. Yes, she had. And she'd let him have her in broad daylight, which, from her limited understanding, was practically unchristian. But she held her tongue because her uncle might applaud such behaviour. Instead, with an exasperated sound, she turned on her heel and stormed out of the house, refusing to waste one more minute of her time conversing with the drunkard. Dumpling was not happy to see her. The Anfield stables were the pony's favourite place to visit since they treated him so well. Sabrina gave the stable lad a coin out of her meagre purse and took the reins, snapping them to send Dumpling pulling the cart down the drive. Her mind was in a tizzy. She had few options. Calling on Mrs. Bosley was out of the question. Her father had made his choice, a fact re-emphasised when she returned home and saw that her father's horse was not in his stall. Sabrina could only pray her father came to his senses soon. Then again, the Earl of Tay was not going to serve as a proper role model. Or maybe the Earl had, and for that reason her father had deserted his family and all of his responsibilities. Whatever was going on, she realised she had little power over his decisions. Instead, she was going to have to take care of herself. The thought was daunting and invigorating in a way she'd not imagined. In the process of unhitching Dumpling, Sabrina paused a moment, evaluating this new realisation. She would take care of herself. The idea had never crossed her mind. She'd been more or less adrift in life, doing what was expected, anticipating others' needs, not ever considering what made her happy. But what if she took Dame Agatha and even her uncle's advice and changed? What if she decided what she would and wouldn't do? Sabrina had never imagined her life beyond the boundaries of her family. She scooped out oats for Dumpling and came to a decision. I'll do my charity work and help those who value my healing skills, but I want to live for myself. And, she added, leaning into the stall so that Dumpling could see she was very serious, I won't feel guilty for what happened this afternoon. She rocked back on her feet. No, I won't, she repeated. She would become like those French women she'd heard about who ran salons and were valued for their intelligence. Maybe she would leave the valley. There was a thought to make her stomach churn with fear. However, there was a world beyond the parish, and she'd experienced none of it. She'd been too busy feeling sorry for herself, just as Dame Agatha had suggested. A thoughtful Sabrina started for the house with a length of rope in her hand. Evening had fallen. The moon was pale in the sky. No lights shone from the windows. Either Mr. Enright had left, which she hoped, or he had not regained consciousness,
and she was going to tie him up. She didn't know what she would do with him after that, but she'd improvise. It would be easiest if she could ask him to leave, and he did so without fuss. Rolf bounded from his post by the step to greet her, and she gave the dog a hug. His presence by the house told her Mr. Enright was probably still her guest. She liked to think Rolf was a good watchdog. She interpreted his wagging tail as a sign all was fine. And yet, an unsettling feeling tickled the hair at the back of her neck, an awareness that perhaps she should be cautious. Sabrina wasn't one for signs, but the other day in the bothy her senses had rightly warned her, and now, once again, she had a recognition of something she could not define. She opened the back door, holding the coil of rope ready so she could use it as a weapon. The hall was dark. No one stirred. "Go inside," she told the dog. His shiny eyes looked doubtful in the moonlight. "Don't worry, Father isn't here." And he wouldn't be. Rolf went inside. She watched his shadow move down the hall. He didn't sound an alarm, pausing first by the study door, convincing himself that his master was not home, then moving on to the kitchen, his favourite room in the house. Meanwhile, Sabrina's stomach rumbled. She barely touched the bread and butter sandwiches at Anfield. She could heat the stew Mrs. Patton had made and kept warm on the hearth, or grab one of the meat pies always kept in the pantry for light meals. A glass of cider would taste good as well. Then she'd have the energy to decide what to do with Mr. Enright. Sabrina bravely walked into the house, her rope at the ready. She didn't have to feel her way. She knew it even in the dark. Without bothering to remove her bonnet, she walked into the kitchen, set her rope aside, and placed a log on the dying fire in the hearth. Flames rose. The tub was where she'd left it. She would have to drag it to the door and pour the water out. She pulled off her driving gloves and placed them on the table, before reaching for a taper on the mantel and lighting it off the glowing fire. Warmth and light filled the room. She started to carry the lit taper to a candle when, once again, she sensed all was not as it should be. Rolf sat on his haunches by the table, ready for a treat. He didn't seem unusually alert. "Father?" Her voice echoed in the darkness. It was silly to think he was there. His horse was not in his stall, and he would have lit the lamp in his study or candles in the kitchen. She blew out the taper and placed it on the table. With cat-like feet, she moved out into the hall. Her eyes adjusted to the darkness. No one was there. The door to her father's study was halfway open. She couldn't remember how it had been when she'd left. She placed her palm on the cool wood and slowly pushed the door open. Moonlight flowed through the windows onto her father's desk. The pen and papers were exactly how he'd left them several days ago. Sabrina couldn't remember the angle of his chair behind his desk, but all seemed as it should be. Everything was quiet save for Rolf's panting. He stood by the kitchen door, waiting hopefully. She released her breath. Her mind was playing tricks on her. There was no sound from upstairs. Her imagination was being overactive. With the intention of returning to the kitchen, Sabrina started to pivot, and that is when a man's figure stepped out from behind the door. Strong arms came down around her.
"Don't struggle. Don't fight," said a deep voice
with a hint of an accent she immediately recognised. "Mr. Enright," she said. He spun her around, his expression as shocked as she felt.
"Angel,"
he whispered, and then blurted out in disbelief.
"Who are you to Davidson?"
There was anger in his voice. Malice. Her very good common sense finally reared its head, and she realised she was being attacked in her own home. This man should not be in her father's study. She started to scream. A hard hand was clamped over her mouth.
"Quiet, will you?" he said. "I'll not harm you if you will be quiet."
Harm her? Sabrina decided now was a good time to begin taking care of herself. She stomped on the toe of his boot with the heel of her sensible shoes. She put all her weight into the action and was rewarded with a very satisfying Irish grunt. His hold loosened. She pushed him away from her and would have taken off running, except he grabbed her arm.
"I'm not going to hurt you," he claimed. "I want Davidson."
"My father?" The words rushed out of her in alarm.
Mr. Enright had been lying in wait for her father, and he believed she found that reassuring. As magistrate, her father had made enemies, and apparently she had allowed one of them to have his way with her. To think she'd nursed this man back to health and, on some level, had grown to trust him. But she shouldn't have. He was a viper. In fairness, he seemed equally shocked.
Your father? I deflowered Davidson's daughter?
He didn't wait for her answer, but muttered,
This is not good, not good at all.
He was right. And to show him how right he was, she curled her fingers into claws and attacked. Chapter 9. Mac didn't know what startled him most, that his angel was Davidson's daughter or the ferocity of her attack. Instead of running like any sensible woman should, she charged him without fear. Her eyes in the moonlight were alive with outrage, and as she surged forward, she reminded him of nothing less than a banshee, those demons of Irish law. He stepped back, bumping into the doorframe, then moving into the hall. She followed, ready to scratch the skin off of him. Her dog had caught on to the melee and began barking and running around them. Mac almost tripped over the animal. The dog snapped his teeth and tried to grab his coat. Mac didn't feel he could fight back, but he did want her to stop hurting him. A time or two she landed a blow or a scratch that was not pleasant. He kept retreating, leading her toward the kitchen, where there would be more space for him to manoeuvre than in the narrow hall. She ruthlessly went after him. Inside the larger room, Mac ducked under her arms and reached for her waist. Using his superior strength, he easily lifted her off the floor and upended her over his shoulder. She kicked her legs wildly and attempted to reach around him in the most unladylike way possible to strike a blow. He had to admire her. She was protecting her father. His business with her sire was deadly serious. However, she had changed the game. Mac owed her his life. He might have survived his illness without her care, but it would have taken longer for him to recover. And, while holding her struggling body against his, he realised that making love to her had done more to restore his spirit than any amount of nursing could have achieved. This woman had true passion. Even now he felt himself respond to her in spite of her wanting to rip the ears off of his head. So she must stop this nonsense. He needed to find her father, and she was a distraction. He set her on her feet with a thud and whirled her around before she could react. He grabbed both her arms below the shoulders and held her captive. He was ready to order her to behave. But the words died in his throat. The fire from the hearth filled the kitchen with golden flickering light. The bonnet she'd been wearing had come undone and fallen to the floor somewhere in their struggles. Her hair tumbled down around her shoulders in thick, round curls. Her eyes sparkled with defiance and, yes, fear. Luminous eyes that told him she was afraid, but she'd not run. Eyes that could bring a man to his knees.
I don't want to fight, he said. Not with you.
And because he couldn't help himself, and because it was what he desired, he kissed her. It was the reasonable action in an unreasonable situation. Nor was this kiss a common one. He couldn't remember the last time he'd kissed a woman out of true, yearning desire, and not just to meet earthy needs. There was also a question in his kiss as well. She had given to him what should have been her gift to a lover. He wanted to know why, to understand, and the mystery of her, combined with the tightening in his loins, was a potent mix. The world faded away. He didn't even register the dog's barking. Miss Davidson resisted. Oh, yes, she did. Her reaction was what he had anticipated. She was going to deny him. Her lips were hard and unyielding, but her body no longer strained away from him. Instead, she had gone still, unwilling to surrender, and yet no longer ready to fight. He sensed her internal struggle. She was as attracted to him as he found himself to her. It was there in the kiss. A brush of the lips, and the energy between them changed, even though she kept hers tightly closed. She was determined not to yield, and yet she didn't shy from him either. This woman was a challenge, and right now he didn't care what her relationship was to Richard Davidson. She attracted him. He wanted her to touch him. He wanted it very much.
Thwack!
The sound accompanied the force of a broomstick across his shoulders.
Unhand her,
a woman's voice ordered. Such was the power of the kiss, it took Mac a second to feel any pain. He raised an arm to defend himself, but he didn't want to let his lips leave Miss Davidson's until he was whacked with the broomstick a second time, this time across the back of his ribs and with more force. He released Miss Davidson and faced his attacker, an older woman of indeterminate age. She had greying blonde curls beneath a jaunty flower bonnet. The same sort of flowery pattern was repeated in her violet and blue dress. Lace gloves covered her hands holding the broomstick. His first thought was to Miss Davidson's safety. This woman was obviously mad. He reached to keep his captive protectively behind him, but she had already scampered away.
"Who are you?"
he demanded of his new opponent. Her response was to swing the broomstick with an impressive show of strength. It whooshed through the air, smacking him hard on the other side of his ribs. Just as he winced from that pain, a good-sized pottery mug whizzed by his head. He was under attack. Miss Davidson had fled his arms only to begin pulling cups and bowls off the cupboard beside her. She threw them at him with all her might. And then there was a dog barking. Mac knew when to run. Unfortunately, the flower lady blocked his escape to the door. He leaped across the table, uncertain how he was going to extricate himself from this complication. He raised his hands to sue for peace. Miss Davidson threw another cup. It hit him in the shoulder.
All right, he said, his temper growing. Let's talk about this.
The flower lady swooshed the air with her broomstick. Mac ducked in time to save his head. He straightened, ready to grab that broomstick from her and break it in half, when he realised the women were no longer paying attention to him. Instead, Miss Davidson, her hand in the air, ready to lob a soup bowl in his direction, stared at her compatriot in open-mouthed surprise.
"What are you doing here, Mrs. Bosley?"
The flower lady had swung so hard she'd stumbled a step, sending her bonnet down over her eyes. She pushed it back with her arm.
"Helping you?"